The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Anyone seen the documentary, I'm Not Your Negro? Okay, show of hands. Okay, everyone, cool. Awesome, great. It's free on Amazon now, by the way, if you haven't seen it. And if you have Amazon Prime, go ahead and check it out. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. James Baldwin was born in 1924, and he died in 1987. He was born in Harlem. He was the grandson of a former slave. His grandmother had been an enslaved worker before the Civil War, and he was the oldest of nine children. He was the stepson of the only father he knew. His stepfather was a church minister, and it was in his footsteps that James Baldwin would become a young preacher in the church. James would develop a style of communicating that he would use later as a writer to communicate so vividly and so, I think, rhythmically the sense of pain most people in the world go through in a style that is characteristically Baldwin. He was a skilled writer from a young age, and with the encouragement from his English teacher, he pursued writing. He left the church at 14 and focused on his writing. He had already been winning small awards at this time. With the help of Richard Wright, author of Native Son, and whose works Baldwin would later critique, causing a falling out between the two, with his help, Baldwin secured a fellowship to live in Paris and write. James Baldwin wrote several books, fiction and nonfiction, as well as plays. He also spoke frequently at events, having participated in the early 60s in a speaking tour in the South organized by the civil rights group CORE. Baldwin was active in the movement and politically affected by it, particularly by its radical wing, by Malcolm X, by the Black Panther Party. Some of Baldwin's most important works I'll just mention quickly. The result of his first visit to Paris was his debut novel, Go Tell It to the Mountain. Anyone read that? All right, cool. Published in 1953, and on the heels of its success, he published Notes of a Native Son, a collection of nonfiction essays, published in 1955. 1 year later, he published Giovanni's Room, an excellent book. On the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1963, he published The Fire Next Time, and in 1972, Baldwin published one of my favorites, No Name in the Street, a collection of nonfiction essays. And I think this book in particular, which I'll talk about quite a bit, is a reflection. It reflects a radical transformation in Baldwin's politics. Itself a reflection of a radical transformation in the civil rights movement at the time. In 1979, he published his last novel, and in my opinion, his best, Just Above My Head. Baldwin continued to write in his later years, and he eventually died in 1987 from stomach cancer. So. Today, Baldwin's works, and particularly I think his later more radical works, are being discovered by a new generation of activists, and this is exciting. This fact is confirmed by the release last year of the excellent documentary, I'm Not Your Negro, a film based on an unpublished manuscript. And on his book, No Name in the Street. I think it's understandable why James Baldwin is becoming popular again. For most people, and for black people in particular, it seems not much has changed since his time, or much of it has for the worse. Many black people are still confined in ghettos, for example, and in those neighborhoods that are seeing improvements, gentrification is displacing longstanding residents. Cops are routinely harassing and killing black and brown people with impunity, even if the murder is documented, which in this age is much more common, obviously, than in Baldwin's time. I think today there's a high expectation for justice among young people, and then there's so little of that justice being actually delivered. And there's also, I think, a new set of politics being people are holding, and those are politics centered on solidarity. But there's a lack of organization and a lack of sustained movements, and I think this entire combination produces a moment today where people very quickly go through cycles of ambition and militancy and confusion and demoralization as well. People have an urge to fight, know that there needs to be a fight, but in the absence of large and independent and democratic and militant spaces, there's little sense on how and where to get plugged in indefinitely. And I think it's in this context that Baldwin taps into the profound sense of alienation most people go through, an alienation that the young Marx explained as the result of capitalism, an alienation which causes people to lose their sense of humanity, that disrupts relationships, that causes hatred between groups of people as they compete for the few crumbs that are actually available to them. And I think it's this sense of alienation from being oppressed, from being poor, or black, or gay, or woman, that Baldwin in his writings captures so well. Why Baldwin's works resonate today, because these days this sense of alienation is so heightened. The rich are making record profits, militancy, movement work is in a bit of a lull, lowest it's been in decades in a sense. Baldwin wrote about a need for love in a world that seems so loveless and the impossibility of simply just waiting for justice to be delivered. Baldwin wrote, which is the title of this talk, and nothing can be changed until it is faced. And it's on this basis, with this sense of urgency, that people today are reading Baldwin. All of Baldwin's works are incredibly profound and insightful, but they're not all the same. There are differences not just in the quality of his writings, but in the politics that they convey. When James Baldwin published Notes of a Native Son, he was a liberal who hoped for a peaceful way out of racism, a mainstream position that characterized the early civil rights movement. By the end of the 60s and early 70s, Baldwin made a complete break with liberalism and became a militant socialist. This transformation in Baldwin, an embodiment of a larger transformation in mid-20th century American politics, clearly affected what Baldwin wrote. Many critics and academics criticized the so-called later Baldwin for being grumpy and pessimistic, having been corrupted by the maniacal Black Power movement. But there's a reason why this later Baldwin was chosen to be depicted in the documentary I'm Not Your Negro. As Baldwin went through the experience of the 60s of being let down by liberals who had the resources to start wars abroad, but not the guts to challenge their Jim Crow colleagues with which they belonged to the same party, from this experience, Baldwin recognized the limits of the system and became a radical. Notes of a Native Son. His first nonfiction book was published in 1955, a year after the Brown versus Board of Education, that rule that separate but unequal, at least in schools, was in fact unconstitutional. It was also in the year of the Montgomery bus boycott that this book was published, an event that essentially kickstarted the civil rights movement. The leaders of this movement, including MLK Jr., believe that if persuaded through the movement's peaceful actions by appealing to the government's morality, the federal government would end Jim Crow and usher in a new era of integration and genuine equal rights throughout the country. For many years, organizations in the movement worked to secure allies among Democrats in the federal government, and as a result, the early civil rights movement, as long as it, I think, tried to establish this dependency on the Democratic Party, moderated itself to an extent for a white liberal audience, and therefore, I think, constricted its full potential. In the March in Washington in 63, which Malcolm X had criticized essentially as a dog and pony show, the organizers famously moderated SNCC leader John Lewis's speech. They also removed James Baldwin from the speaker's list, presumably for being gay. Militants from SNCC and CORE had wanted the event to be a mass action of civil disobedience. Instead, it was organized as a show of force in support of Kennedy's watered-down civil rights bill pending in Congress. MLK's speech at the March in Washington also had been criticized by militants for leaving out commentary on the recent violence in the South. For example, on May 2nd, during the Birmingham campaign, thousands of people, including children, women, including pregnant women, senior citizens, they were beaten, they were sprayed with hose, arrested. Militants had also criticized MLK's speech for having avoided criticism of liberal politicians who were responsible for the economic plight of black people. A year later, during LBJ's presidential campaign, MLK had called for suspending protests for fear that acts of civil disobedience would jeopardize Johnson's election. In exchange for his endorsements of civil rights legislation, MLK campaigned for Johnson, and in that year, actually, rebellions broke out in ghettos in Rochester, Philadelphia, and Harlem. King called for rioters oppressed by Northern liberals for decades to return home because, quote, lawlessness, looting, and violence cannot be condoned, whether used by the racist or the reckless of any color. So the movement's reliance on the Democratic Party sometimes resulted resulted in the substituting campaigning for actually building mass action and organization, having the effect of adapting the movements to the demands of white liberalism over the spontaneous militancy of the black and poor. It was in this era of the civil rights movement's Cold War liberalism that Baldwin was first writing about as a conception of racism. So back to Notes of a Native Son, like all of Baldwin's works earlier or later, in fact, Notes of a Native Son is such an excellent book because it articulates, I think, with beautiful prose, the day-to-day thoughts and feelings of black people as they actually are. In the essay Many Thousands Gone in the book, he writes, and there is, I should think, no Negro living in America who has not felt briefly or for long periods with anguish or sharp or dull in varying degrees and to varying effects, simple, naked, and unanswerable hatred, who has not wanted to smash any white face he may encounter in a day, to break the bodies of all white people and bring them low as that dust into which he himself has been and is being trampled. No Negro, finally, who has not had to make his own precarious adjustments to the nigger who surrounds him and to the nigger in himself. And in his essay, The Harlem Ghetto, he writes about how black people are always adjusting their behavior for the comfort of white people at the expense of their own humanity. Along this vein, in the essay named after his book, Notes of a Native Son, he talks tragically about a stepfather who claimed to have been proud of his blackness, but according to Baldwin, it had been the cause of much humiliation and it had fixed bleak boundaries to his life. His father was notoriously bitter, is the way Baldwin puts it, and angry, ruining his relationships with his children. It was after his death, after his funeral, which took place actually during the Harlem riots of 1943, a moment that Baldwin describes vividly and emotionally. It was after his stepfather's death that Baldwin discovered that black people were doomed to this bitterness and all of the consequences of that bitterness as long as they had to live what he called the weight of white people. It's in these moments in Notes of a Native Son that the reader feels tragically the alienation that the oppressed suffer through. Racism causes a loss of a sense of individuality, of community, and overall humanity, which affects black people, but as Baldwin claimed throughout his whole life, affects white people as well. So Baldwin writes at the end of his book, Notes of a Native Son, in the essay Stranger in the Village, he writes, "People who shut their eyes to reality simply invite their own destruction. And anyone who insists on remaining in a state of innocence long after that innocence is dead turns himself into a monster." Okay, Notes of a Native Son is usually the Baldwin book. How many of you have read it? Okay, quite a few. It's usually the Baldwin book and usually one of the only ones that people are introduced to in academia. I think it's easy to read the book through a liberal lens and see it as nothing more than a liberal account of racism produced for a white audience. Yet, this is not the case, I think, if it's read closely. He constantly criticizes liberals, both black and white. He mocks a liberal who had said to him, "As long as books are being published," an American liberal once said to me, "everything will be all right." Speaking about a black-owned newspaper, Baldwin wrote, "The editorial concluded that Negroes had come a long way and that, as patriotic Americans, it was time we stopped singing the blues and realized just how bright the future was." Baldwin goes so far as to say, "One cannot help observing that some Negro leaders and politicians are far more concerned with their careers than with the welfare of Negroes." So it's true that Baldwin is not a Marxist, and he criticizes Richard Wright, presumably, for being one to the extent that it affected the quality of his characters and his stories. For Baldwin, who respected Richard Wright tremendously, his issue with Wright was not that his stories were influenced by radical theory per se, but because of Wright's dogma and his characters, like Bigger in Native Son, which Baldwin felt Wright's characters were unrealistic and at worst caricatures of black people. The controversy between Baldwin and Wright, which we can talk more about in discussion if you guys want, the controversy between them is usually ascribed to Baldwin's alleged belief that art and so-called protest literature were incompatible, but in Baldwin's obituary for Wright, this doesn't seem to be the basis for his criticism of Wright. In Notes of a Native Son, Baldwin, in fact, seems to have no principled issue with the fusion of Marxism and black politics. He says, "In the 30s, swallowing Marx whole, we discovered the worker, and realized, I should think with some relief, that the aims of the worker and the aims of the Negro were one. Now, this is not to say that Baldwin had no criticisms of the class analysis from Marxist theory, but it should be understood that he was criticizing, I think, a Stalinized Marxism that had distorted the meaning of class in theory and in practice. The Communist Party, by the Second World War, had ceased to be the militant party that organized militant blacks in the factories in the north and in the southern mills and plantations. During the war, the Communist Party subordinated itself to the Stalinist bureaucracy, which resulted in its dependency on liberal governments, which itself resulted in abandoning mass action. And within this, its ability really to challenge racism in the unions and in society. It could not, for example, challenge Jim Crow as long as it subordinated itself to Northern Democrats, who had an interest in politically protecting their segregationist colleagues in the South. So it's within this context, I think it should be clear that what Baldwin means when he writes, the relationship of the Negro to the worker cannot be summed up, nor even greatly illuminated by saying that their aims are one. It is true only insofar as they both desire better working conditions and useful only insofar as they unite their strength as workers to achieve these ends. Further than this, we cannot in honesty go. So as Marxists, we should understand that this is true, that issues of oppression cannot be reduced, so to speak, to class, an abstraction which really makes no sense at all in theory and in practice. Because this results in an attempt, I think, to wage narrow economic struggles, an attempt that itself fails. Since to unite workers in a battle, let's say for higher wages, their differences have to be addressed and overcome precisely because it is based on the division among workers that bosses and politicians secure their power. So the early Baldwin was, this is all to say, the early Baldwin was more radical than liberals today may give him credit for. Yet he does, to an extent, reflect the dominant politics of that time. He establishes his acceptability to Cold War liberalism when, in the beginning of Notes of a Native Son, he states, I love America more than any other country in the world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. He establishes his aversion to any particular radical system of thought when he states, I think all theories are suspect. His words are consistent with the nonviolence like philosophy and strategy of MLK and the early civil rights movement when he says, one must find, therefore, one owns moral center and move through the world hoping that this center will guide one aright. For Baldwin, the fundamental division in society, at least as early Baldwin, is between black and white people, not classes. So his explanation for the reproduction of racism are usually ascribed to, quote, the white man's motive and the protection of his identity, which leaves the question, I think, of how and why white people are motivated in the first place to establish this identity. We see that as long as Baldwin remained within the confines of Cold War liberal ideology, which he will abandon in large chunks throughout the 60s, his vision for the end of racism is very peaceful, based on multiculturalist notions of love and acceptance. So developments in the civil rights movements and in global politics throughout the 60s would cause a radical transformation in Baldwin. By 63, when Baldwin publishes his acclaimed nonfiction book, The Fire Next Time, anyone read that one? Cool. Great book. The civil rights movement had in the driver's seat now at this time young people, black and white alike, who had detonated a new wave of desegregation protests by using the sit-in tactic, first in North Carolina in 1960 and then quickly throughout the country. These young people in action infused a new militancy into the movement. They looked not to the courts like the NAACP and the traditional civil rights groups had, but to direct action itself to deliver the goods. They had none of the Cold War liberal baggage their elders did. They were infants during the anti-communist hysteria, during the post-war period, during the McCarthy era. They were just kids, and the silencing of black militants, including Du Bois and Robeson in the 50s, they weren't really around for that. They saw, therefore, no need to confine their strategy to legalistic and electoral channels. As a result, they sat in, and black and white together rode buses from the north throughout the south to show the world how the freest country in the world, led by Democrats, treated its most vulnerable people. Through their brave actions, these young people, who were not revolutionaries, but militant reformers. They exposed the hypocrisy, the cowardice of Northern Democrats. I mean, Attorney General Robert Kennedy had famously told core organizers to cut all that shit, freedom riding and sitting in shit, I'll get you tax-free status. They saw, these young people saw how little Northern Democrats did to protect protesters when Southern cops beat and jailed them. They saw that when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passed, how much more needed to be done. Bombings and lynchings were still rampant. Throughout the country, black people lived in economic despair. The right was on the rise as segregationist George Wallace's popularity increased. And all the while, liberal politicians saw the matter close with the passing of legislation, and so had told activists to go home. This situation, including the beginning of the Vietnam War, radicalized the civil rights movement. Experiencing the limits of reform, the uselessness of liberalism, the emboldening of the right, and connecting the war abroad with the war at home, more and more people, black and white, younger and older, were in a sense compelled to question the entire system. In other words, they were compelled, in a sense, to become revolutionaries. So MLK, despite the insistence of his colleagues, gave in 1967 his Beyond Vietnam speech and announced to the world, in this moment, I think, his break with Cold War liberalism. Many activists questioning exactly what it is that they were trying to integrate into thought that capitalism itself was, in MLK's words, an edifice which produces beggars that needs restructuring. You know, it's capitalism that was the source of racist violence, both in the South and the North. So the Black Panther Party formed in Oakland in 1966. At the turn of the decade, black Marxist auto workers formed a workshop organization called the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. What started as a movement for civil rights in the 1950s had transformed into a movement for black power. Now, it's the hallmark of a good writer, attuned to the mood and I think the capabilities of the masses, that Baldwin himself was affected by the social radicalization of the 60s. Throughout this time, Baldwin was not one who sat on the sidelines, but participated actively. For CORE, like I mentioned earlier, he did speaking tours and participated in debates in the South. He was at the March on Washington in 1963, the Selma March in 65. Through his activism, he got to know, as you guys know if you've seen the documentary, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, MLK Jr., whose murders throughout the decade, Medgar in 1962, Malcolm in 65, MLK in 68, impacted Baldwin emotionally and politically. And No Name in the Street, the one I said that was my favorite, published in 1972. He reflects on his initial involvement in the movement, back in the 50s. He had been in France, living in France in 1957 when he heard about the abuse Dorothy Counts, a 15-year-old black student in North Carolina, went through when she went to attend her newly integrated school. Baldwin felt unsatisfied being away from the States while people were risking their lives for civil rights. He wrote, "I could simply no longer sit around in Paris discussing the Algerian and black American problem. Everybody else was paying their dues, and it was time I went home and paid mine." In his book, he reflects on his days before he became a radical, to a time when many of us believed, or made ourselves believe, that the American state still contained within itself the power of self-confrontation, the power to change itself in the direction of honor and knowledge and freedom. He recalls that in those great days, I was considered to be an integrationist, and that, quote, "without realizing it, I was the great black hope of the great white father." Baldwin in 72 in his book was questioning the old civil rights strategy before the rise of black power. Malcolm was very caustic about the March on Washington, which he described as a sellout. I think he was right. The reasoning behind the March on Washington as it eventually evolved, or as it was in Malcolm's words, diluted, was that peaceful assembly would produce the best results. But 5 years later, it was very hard to believe that the frontal assault as planned on the Capitol could possibly have produced more bloodshed or more despair. 5 years later, it seemed that we had merely postponed, and not at all to our advantage, the hour of our dreadful reckoning. Baldwin rejected Cold War liberal ideology by this point, by becoming an internationalist. Baldwin, like the Black Panthers and militants at the time, was profoundly affected by the Vietnam War and the complicity of liberals, drawing in his work several comparisons, in fact, between black people in the States and the Viet Cong and the Vietnamese in general. In No Name, he recounts meeting a friend, a postal worker, and getting into a pretty nasty debate with him about his friend's support for the Vietnam War. The tone he chooses to write about the meeting speaks volumes, I think, about the impact of Baldwin's radicalization on himself. Baldwin's friend tries to explain why he thinks the United States is in Vietnam by using the pronoun we. Baldwin reacts strongly. "We," I cried. "What motherfucking we? You stand up. You stand up, motherfucker, and I'll kick you in the ass." The Baldwin of Notes of a Native Son, the one who wrote, "I love America, and that's why I choose to criticize her," having seen by 1972 what, quote, what America is doing within her borders, she was doing around the world, now considers the possibility that, quote, "he has no compassion whatsoever for my country or my countrymen." So Baldwin has started his career with criticizing liberals. It's important to note. But the hypocrisy of liberal politicians throughout the 60s, first in resisting the impulses of the civil rights movements, then leading a war against colored people abroad, this enrages Baldwin. So by 1963, in his book, The Fire Next Time, he begins to acknowledge the limits of a reformist strategy, stating that very few liberals have any notion of how long, how costly, and how heartbreaking a task it is to gather the evidence that one can carry into court, or how long such court battles take. In 63, he also writes about liberal politicians who are patronizing and condescending to black activists, a point he makes in a debate for which the footage appears in the documentary I'm Not Your Negro. They have, quote, the notion that they are in possession of some intrinsic value that black people need or want. And this assumption, which, for example, makes the solution to the Negro problem depend on the speed with which Negroes accept and adopt white standards, is revealed in all kinds of striking ways, including Bobby Kennedy's assurance that a Negro can become president in 40 years, if we're good, is what Baldwin says. By 1972, Baldwin minces no words about his feelings towards liberal politicians. He recalls the McCarthy era, which, quote, "taught me something about the irresponsibility and cowardice of the liberal community, which I'll never forget. I watched them do to each other during the McCarthy era things which were in some ways worse than anything they had ever done to me." He recalls from his youth, in retrospect, the, strong words here, the chicken shit goodwill of liberals, whose uselessness has become exposed by the time of black power. He writes, "watching the Northern reaction to the Black Panthers, observing the abject cowardice with which the Northern populations allow them to be menaced, jailed, and murdered, and all this, with but the faintest pretense of legality, can fill one with the great contempt for the emancipated North, which but only yesterday was so full of admiration and sympathy for the heroic blacks in the South." By this point in his life, Baldwin is absolutely fed up with the liberal company, black included, that he had kept once upon a time. In No Name, he writes, "I was never going to be anybody's nigger again." He recounts something his sister Gloria had said to him. "I am tired," Gloria sometimes said. "I'm tired of these middle-class, college-educated darkies who never saw a rat or a roach in their lives and who never starved or worked a day, who just turned black last week, coming and telling me what it means to be black." The older Baldwin also breaks with notions of love and acceptance as solutions to racism. In The Fire Next Time, he is still grappling, I think, this is 63, he's still grappling with his radicalizing politics, but the reader can see him moving away from the politics of love and acceptance. When Baldwin, writing about the Brown versus Board of Ed decision, says, "most of the Negroes I know do not believe that this immense concession would ever have been made if it had not been for the competition of the Cold War and the fact that Africa was clearly liberating herself and therefore had, for political reasons, to be wooed by the descendants of her former masters. Had it been a matter of love or justice, the 1954 decision would surely have occurred sooner." Almost a decade later now, radicalized by the Black Power movement, Baldwin would write, and he's writing about Faulkner here, he, Faulkner, wants the old order, which came into existence through unchecked greed and wanton murder, to redeem itself without further bloodshed, without, that is, any further menacing itself, and without coercion. This old orders never do, less because they would not than because they cannot. They cannot because they have always existed in relation to a force which they have had to subdue. This subjugation is the key to their identity and the triumph and justification of their history. And it is also on the continued subjugation that their material well-being depends. Baldwin at this point believes that peace cannot be had between the oppressor and the oppressed. They cannot talk it out because the subdued and the subduer do not speak the same language. So, quote, all attempts at dialogue break down. to what Baldwin wrote. Baldwin no longer believes we should, as he had written earlier in The Fire Next Time, that we must accept our oppressors and accept them with love. The way that Baldwin talks about oppression, I think, itself changes, becomes more precise throughout his career. In Notes of the Native Son, he talks broadly about white people and their actions to the extent that they emanate from their attitudes toward black people and about white people's feelings about themselves and about their identity. In 1972, I think he's developed a class analysis of power. In No Name, he talks bluntly about how American oil interests don't give a shit about human life. When discussing the compatibility of black rights and capitalism, he says that black capitalism is a concept demanding yet more faith and infinitely more in schizophrenia than the concept of the virgin birth. He recounts a story of how a powerful white politician once groped him, a politician who had the power with a phone call to prevent or provoke a lynching. He now starts to differentiate between the power held among different groups of white people. Baldwin makes clear, I think, that it is the white capitalists and black capitalists too who have power over not just black people but most white people as well. In his open letter, beautiful, beautiful open letter to Angela Davis, who was in prison at the time, he writes, "The will of the people in America has always been at the mercy of an ignorance not merely phenomenal but sacred and sacredly cultivated, the better to be used by a carnivorous economy which democratically slaughters and victimizes whites and blacks alike." For Baldwin, the ruling class has power over even the middle upper class, so what we would call privileged sections of the white population. Baldwin speaks about the white college-educated activists in the movement in this way. They had not realized how cheaply, after all, the rulers of the Republic held their white lives to be. Coming to the defense of the rejected and destitute, they were confronted with the extent of their own alienation in the unimaginable dimensions of their own poverty. They were privileged and secure only so long as they did, in effect, what they were told. But they had been raised to believe that they were free. In his open letter to Angela Davis, he also writes, "White lives, for the forces which rule in this country are no more sacred than black ones, as many and many a student is discovering, as the white American corpses in Vietnam prove." He ends his book, No Name, again published in 1972, at a moment when the right now has taken power. Baldwin writes in the revealing display of his radical analysis of power that, quote, "Mr. Nixon has congratulated Mr. Rockefeller, who has congratulated the police." Baldwin, at this point in the career, is, I think, clear that he feels most white people are not just morally unfree, which is true and which is his main point in his early works, but politically and materially oppressed as well. By the time he publishes No Name again in 1972, I think Baldwin's a socialist. This is a new development in Baldwin's political life, I argue. He now starts advocating an alternative to capitalism and to the study of economics, in fact, to understand race relations. As early as 1963, in the beginning of his radicalization, Baldwin, for the first time, I think, is exceptionally clear and straightforward about his thoughts on the origin and reproduction of racism. Racism was, as it continues to be, merely a tool of the ruling class to justify the exploitation of the oppressed. That's me. That's not Baldwin. Just introducing Baldwin's argument. In a lecture to public school teachers, he makes that argument. Quote, "The point of all this is that black men were brought here as a source of cheap labor. They were indispensable to the economy. In order to justify the fact that men were treated as though they were animals, the white republic had to brainwash itself into believing that they were indeed animals and deserved to be treated like animals." It, racism, he means, was a deliberate policy hammered into place in order to make money from black flesh. Straightforward. The alternative to capitalism, a system enhanced by oppression, is one that has no place for oppression, I think is what Baldwin is arguing, and that system is socialism. So back to No Name in the Street. Baldwin, recalling his visit to Black Panther Party leader Huey P. Newton, Baldwin says, "Huey believes, and I do too, in the necessity of establishing a form of socialism in this country. The necessity for a form of socialism is based on the observation that the world's present economic arrangements doom most of the world to misery. that the way of life dictated by these arrangements is both sterile and immoral, and finally, that there is no hope for peace in the world so long as these arrangements obtain. So for Baldwin, obtaining the necessity of socialism means studying theory. Departure from his liberal days when, again, in Notes of a Native Son, he wrote, I think all theories are suspect. Baldwin now says, to study the economic structure of this country, to know which hands control the wealth, and to which end seems an academic exercise. And yet it is necessary, all of it necessary, for discipline, for knowledge, and for power. I wish Baldwin was still alive so we can invite him to the conference. This quote, in my opinion, sounds a lot like, what Lenin wrote, and what is to be done when he said, without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. Baldwin, just to be clear, never described himself, as far as I know, as a Marxist, but he was now speaking like one and identifying his politics with those, like the Black Panthers, who were explicitly Marxist. The impact of the 60s, in short, caused Baldwin to break sharply with liberalism for socialism. Good transition to make. Baldwin understood that to fight the system required solidarity. Throughout his entire career, Baldwin realized that the oppression of one group is bound to the oppression of all groups, and so the end of oppression in its totality required this solidarity. Back to The Fire Next Time, he wrote, if we, and I mean the relatively conscious whites and the relatively conscious blacks, who must, like lovers, insist on or create the consciousness of others, do not falter in our duty, we may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and achieve our country and change the history of the world. By the time of No Name, almost a decade later now, as the Vietnam War made clear that the government was committed to oppression and exploitation everywhere, including at home, Baldwin's concept of solidarity, I think, expanded. He became, as I said earlier, an internationalist. Solidarity between blacks and whites in the U.S., I think he saw was not enough because racism could not be overcome at home while it was being perpetrated abroad. So solidarity was necessary among all oppressed peoples across the world, a solidarity in opposition to and not in cooperation with the ruling class. And so in No Name in the Street, he writes, and of course, any real commitments to black freedom in this country would have the effect of reordering all of our priorities and altering all of our commitments so that, for horrendous example, we should be supporting black freedom fighters in South Africa and Angola and would not be allied with Portugal, would be closer to Cuba than we are to Spain, would be supporting the Arab nations instead of Israel, and would never have felt compelled to follow the French into Southeast Asia. But such a course would forever wipe the smile from the face of that friend as all rejoice to have at Chase Manhattan. Now we can understand why, and I'll finish here, why the later Baldwin was called grumpy and pessimistic, because he no longer had faith that the current system could be fixed, but that, as a new layer of militants were arguing, capitalism itself needed to be replaced, dismantled entirely, and replaced with socialism. In Baldwin's novels throughout his career, the reader sees characters who seem so realistic, so genuine. What a great writer. We see his characters suffering through from the intertwined alienation of oppressed groups. David in Giovanni's room, for example, grappling with his sexuality. Rufus in Another Country, with his identity as a black man. Tish in If Beale Street Could Talk, a young Tish is a young black woman, pregnant while trying to get released from jail, her lover for a crime he didn't commit. And Arthur, in, again, my favorite novel, Just Above My Head, a young black gay gospel singer from Harlem, painfully dealing with his identity, with his life, with losing his friends and lovers to the Jim Crow South and to the imperialist wars. There's so much pain in Baldwin's novels because his writing is, simply put, real. And the world is a painful place. From all of Baldwin's works, including the ones published even in his liberal phase, radicals can learn a great deal about the, I think, day-to-day misery that burdens all different kinds of people. From his nonfiction writings, especially his later ones, the reader, I think, can be convinced, or if readers are already radical, even further convinced that racism is the lifeblood of capitalism, that socialism is the alternative, and that the system must be studied to fight it together with the solidarity linking all oppressed groups worldwide for a common cause, and that is total liberation. The price of not doing this is just too high. Polish revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg said that capitalism is not sustainable. In a society, we have two choices, socialism or barbarism, right? You've heard this before. James Baldwin said something similar in his typical Baldwin way, having been a preacher. He recounts the story of Noah and how the world was destroyed with the flood. Quoting an old slave song, Baldwin wrote, "God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time." Contrary to liberal critics, Baldwin was rightfully pessimistic that anyone in this tyrannical system can ever be free. As socialists, it's our duty to make sure that we avoid the fire that can destroy humanity, if you will. Baldwin wrote, he was a writer because he thought that we could avoid this fire, a fire fueled by the profit motive that consumes our humanity. I think we can avoid the fire next time by uniting and fighting for a socialist society. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.